We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 30th of March, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. We broadcast live every Friday. Today, the programme was pre-recorded. It's Good Friday. The show was pre-recorded on Thursday, the 29th of March. So the show's going out on FM radio and also through our internet live stream. However you're listening, the programme will also be available as a podcast from the Sheffield Live podcast channel. Talking about podcasts, last week's programme featured Dr. Steve Walker. He's the leader of Art Business Loans in Birmingham, and he was talking about what makes for an exceptional, outstanding leader. We also had Michael Sheen, the actor and activist, on the show talking about the End High Cost Credit Alliance, a movement which he has recently launched. Plus, another chance to catch up with education, Debs Howe. We played an interview with Debs last week. So if you missed last week's show, panic not. It's up on the podcast section of the Sheffield Live website. Go to sheffieldlive.org, look up radio shows, find Business Live, and you'll find the show there. But that was then. This is now. Who's on today? Well, GDPR. It's fast approaching. What does it mean? You probably know that GDPR is going to affect your business, your social enterprise, your charity, your organisation, because it will affect all of us. It's about data, new regulations, and we've talked about it a number of times. We've also mentioned the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, and guidance that they've put out. But I thought it'd be great to get someone with expertise to answer some questions on the programme. And today we have Dr. Heather Anson. She is director at Anson Evaluate and a multi-jurisdictional law consultant at Digital Law UK. So she gives us a fantastic, detailed and in-depth interview for the whole programme today after we've got through a couple of updates in terms of what's been going on in business and in social enterprise. So what has been going on? Well, the number of Yorkshire businesses set to hire more employees has increased during March due to a rise in confidence in the region, according to the latest business barometer from Lloyds Bank Commercial Banking. And that shows that companies here in the region have reported higher confidence in their business prospects at 41% and higher economic optimism at 33%. And this gives together an overall confidence figure of 37%. And that's a significant increase on last month's figure, which came in at 27%. And a net balance of 29% of businesses in Yorkshire expect to hire more staff during the next year. That is up 8 points on last month. And the Business Barometer questions 1,200 businesses monthly and provides early signals about UK economic trends, not only regionally, but also nationwide. The largest round to date of the Community Business Fund is now open. £5 million this time in the fund. It comes from Power to Change, the independent trust supporting community businesses in England. And it announced this week that the next round of their flagship Community Business Fund will open in April. It's going to be £5 million available to be awarded in 2018. Largest round of the fund in the trust's history. And the fund awards grants between £50,000 and £300,000 to established community businesses that need funding for a business development project to make their organisation more financially sustainable. They've had over 900 applications since the fund launched in April 2016, requesting grants to the value of over £130 million, and 90 organisations to date up and down England have been awarded grants totalling £16 million, and the grants cover an extensive range of community businesses that they've supported. Community run cinema, cafes, hubs, ferry boats, and even a lobster hatchery, apparently. The fund will open this round on Tuesday, the 24th of April, And you will have until 12 noon on Tuesday, the 22nd of May, to apply. But you can start to, you can begin to prepare your application from today. All you need to do is visit the Power to Change website, download the guidance, take a look at the details, and go from there. Power to Change are also going to host a webinar in April to give applicants a view, an overview of the fund and eligibility criteria, so you'll be able to take a look there. And if you want to know more, go to powertochange.org.uk/funding/grants/community-business-fund. And you'll get all the information there. So do take a look. What else is going on? Well, Barclays have joined force with The Big Issue and with the Cambridge Judge Business School to launch a social enterprise scale-up UK programme. This aims to support the growth of small to medium social enterprises. Applications have opened now for this programme, and it aims to address challenges that businesses, founders and their senior management teams face in scaling. Apparently, it's highly interactive and practical. The programme will focus on enhancing the performance and competitiveness of social enterprises that take part through a bespoke curriculum. It will give access to industry experts and global thought leaders, they say, and will have an emphasis on peer-to-peer learning, and will provide each founder, each CEO or their senior management team with techniques, commercial frameworks, strategies and other resources to scale businesses and accelerate ambitions. Workshops and augmented by company visits and coaching as well. And cohorts taking place in Birmingham, Cardiff, Bristol, Oxford, Edinburgh, Manchester and London. And so if you'd like to find out more details, then go to jbs.cam.ac.uk. You should find details there, but if you can't, I will be tweeting them out from my Twitter account, at Jamie Veitch. You don't have to have a Twitter account yourself. Just go to Twitter, look up Jamie Veitch, and you'll find a link in my Twitter stream today, which will link through to the application page and the eligibility criteria and more about this, which is all up on the University of Cambridge Judge Business School page. So details there. So a few things there going on in business and social enterprise that you can get involved in, find out more about. What are you up to? What's your business or social enterprise been doing? Have you been doing something innovative, different, unusual, exciting? Would you like to be featured on the programme? Well, you can be. All you need to do is send me an email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org, or a text, 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well, because whether you're starting or running a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an employer, an employee, whether you're self-employed, we're always keen to hear from you. So time now to bring our guest of the day on. And on Wednesday of this week, I had an in-depth conversation for this programme with Dr. Heather Anson. She is director at Anson Evaluate. She's also a law consultant, a multi-jurisdictional law consultant at Digital Law UK. And she has a wealth of knowledge when it comes to data, data regulations, data protection, and of course, particularly GDPR. So let's hear from Heather now about what you need to know when it comes to GDPR. So Heather, welcome back to the show. Thanks very much for joining me for another interview. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back. It's been a while.
It has indeed. I think last time you came on, we were talking about the ifs and buts and the what ifs around politics in America. Should a certain someone become president? Oh dear. Anyway, I brought you on to share your expertise today because I imagine you're exceptionally busy at the moment. So thank you for taking the time. But you're exceptionally busy because you're an expert in terms of data security and data law, aren't you?
Yes, working quite a bit on GDPR. People are starting to realize that this is something that's happening and that we need to do something about. So
Indeed. And to be fair to the Information Commissioner and to, I suppose, policymakers, they have flagged this up, that this was coming for a while now. But as you say,
quite a lot of organizations, whether businesses, social enterprises, or charities, are only just waking up to the fact that they need to do something about it. So they're presumably approaching you, and many doing so perhaps in a little bit of a panic.
Yes, I would say panic is a good description of how many of the people who contact me these days are behaving.
Yes. Right. So what are the most frequently asked questions that people are coming to you and saying, GDPR, I know it's coming, what do I need to do? Or what are they asking you in terms of how you can help them?
Well, the questions that have been asked are actually changing over time. When this first came out, we got a lot of people saying, well, will this really affect us because of Brexit? We won't be in the EU, so we have to really, but that's gone by the wayside as people have realized that, one, we won't be out of the European Union before the end of May when GDPR comes into effect. So obviously we'll still be impacted by it, but also that the UK is adopting legislation that will be matching GDPR. So we'll have it as law of the land either way.
Yes. So
that question has stopped being asked by most people. I think the most common ones are around the consent issue, which is one of the six ways that GDPR allows companies to process data. And that one is of a bit concern, because what does it mean to get consent? What does it mean to have specific informed consent, which is the difference between GDPR and the previous law, the Data Protection Act? Yeah. So that's of a great concern to people, how to do that, how to make sure that's happening. And there's concern over what to do if there is a breach. What is a 72-hour reporting period, and what's going to happen with that?
Yep. Okay, so the questions have moved on because, as you say, people are now aware that it will impact on them, and that's not going to change. In terms of Brexit, won't change the fact that GDPR impacts on your organization. So the questions have changed, and the questions have become more specific themselves. People are aware that there is a need for consent, that consent needs to be informed and specific, or some people are, by the sounds of it, in terms of they're asking you about this, but then how that is manifested in practice, and whether what they've been doing to date meets GDPR regulations, whether, for example, I suppose a charity, a social enterprise, or a business with a opted-in list of subscribers to an email newsletter, some seem to be very concerned that how they've got people onto their list has or has not been GDPR compliant. Do they need to delete the list and start again? Do they need to get everyone to resubscribe again? Or if it was, if the list was put together in compliance with what GDPR will require, are they happy? Do they need to do nothing? And how do you address those sorts of queries, Heather?
Well, the first thing to do is to look at whether or not specific informed consent is the only way that you can be authorized to receive and process data, because it is, as I said, only one of six ways that GDPR allows for that data. There's also by contract and legitimate business purpose. So, for example, if you're ordering something off of Amazon, you're creating a purchase contract with them, and they're able to take the data that's necessary to fulfill that contract, which is to provide you with that service.
Yes.
They also have a legitimate business interest in tracking the package to make sure that what you've gotten to receive and keeping your information on file long enough to make sure that you're happy with the purchase, and if you need to return the purchase. So all those are legitimate business interests. So you can have by contract and by legitimate business interest there.
Right.
So the first question will be, do we need to actually get specific informed consent? In most cases, it probably is in the best interest of a company to do that, especially in terms of marketing. For marketing, there are very few times when the other exceptions will, the other reasons will apply. Hmm. So if we look at that specifically, if you've got an existing list, an existing call list or an existing mail list, you can sort of, you don't have to throw it all out, although there are some businesses that have decided to do that, such as the Wetherspoons chain.
Yes, indeed.
Has decided to completely get rid of their email newsletter system. So they've deleted that entire system. They believe it's not worth the effort, basically. But that's
quite.
Yes. But that's not necessary, though.
Right.
It's not entirely necessary. Although in their case, I can understand that I've been to a Wetherspoons in my life. I don't know that I would go more frequently if I were receiving emails from them, whether I would keep even find them in my email box, especially these days. So it may be that some marketing companies are finding that moving beyond what we do traditionally is the way to go. So this may be helping us clear out our spam, as it were, junk boxes in our email, which could be a good thing.
Yeah, sure.
However, if for your company feels as a marketing tool, it's better to have these lists, but they want to make sure they're compliant, even if they're fairly certain that they got compliance initially, what they'll want to do is, instead of throwing it all out, they can do what a lot of companies have, and I've received these emails as well from companies that I'm on a mailing list for. They send an email saying, this is the upcoming legislation. We need to make sure that we have your specific consent in order to continue sending you these newsletters. If you'd like to continue receiving these newsletters, please click here, respond here, or go onto our website and put on the settings. Something that requires a specific action on behalf of the data subject, the individual whose email address it is.
Yes.
Now it's important that it has to be an action by that individual and not an inaction. So if you don't respond to this, then you're going to be kept in this list. That will not suffice. Also, you need to be careful about how aggressive you are with it. There is a company, and I'm going to not say the name because I don't know if I remember it off the top of my head, but I believe it's one of the major shopping grocery chains.
Okay.
That did in their email pushes were sending out multiple emails to do this, and also when people wouldn't send back, they would follow up with more aggressive emails, going, "Are you sure you're going to miss out on all this? Are you sure? Are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you don't want to?" I mean, it was really, really pushy,
right.
And so they got hit by the ICO for this overly aggressive attempt to get that permission.
Yes, indeed. Sounds like they have really annoyed folk who presumably reported them to the ICO. And led to the ICO taking that action. Okay. Interesting. Very, very interesting.
Mm. The only other aspect of the specific informed consent I want to make sure that's pointed out is the term specific, which means that for each use of the data that you're going to have, you have to get consent. So the blanket consent form is no longer okay. The read our terms and conditions, which have all of those things that we're going to use your data for in there, click here to say you consent to it. So it has to be specific. So we're going to, do we have your permission to use your email for marketing and newsletters? Click here. Work for us to use analytics. Click here. So there has to be specific consent for each use of it.
Yes, I see. So you can't just do a sort of one size fits all catch all, and people are opting into everything.
Yes, and also you can't have the pre-ticked boxes like they have now in a lot of sites. They're going to have to change after May.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. So we've started talking about this with regard to marketing, but of course it applies to personal data, which will be used by companies, by social enterprises, by organizations for plenty of other purposes beyond the fact that they want to market to people. We have tracking. People routinely use tracking cookies on websites and even retargeting cookies to show ads to people who've visited Yes. their sites. And then there is the use of data for storing details of your employees. So there is a legitimate use of HR data by Yes. organizations, but ever such a lot of personal records there, and plenty of other instances in which data is used. So this is going to be quite complicated for folk.
It is, and actually, how you brought it up makes it even. Brings up two points of complication. The easier one of the two is the question of how long you keep data, and you gave the example of HR and keeping employees' data.
Yes.
And the new regulation talks about not keeping data for as long as is necessary. Now, that's not a finite time because it can't be a one size fits all for each one. For example, in the circumstance of HR, if you've got an employee who has left employment, the question is, how long is it appropriate to keep their data for, all the data that you have on file for them? And we've sought the advice of employment and HR law experts to find out what the appropriate amount of time would be for what they would consider the appropriate amount of time in that specific area. And they have said that 1 year, unless there is a pending tribunal action, that you should not keep more than the name and time, the name of the employee, the time period at which they worked there, and the role or roles at which they worked beyond that year. And it also applies to when you get CVs in, when you're doing employment, you've got CVs, you've done the interviews, you've hired the people. The CVs that you don't use of the people you've not employed, they shouldn't be kept on file unless you specifically ask those people if you can keep their CV on file for a specific amount of time. And again, that shouldn't be longer than 6 months to a year.
Right, so that is something that people may well not have considered, but a really crucial point. Yeah.
So it's going to be, there's going to be specific answers to each one of those questions. Well, what about this piece of data, and what about that piece of data?
Yeah, certainly. Okay, thanks for that. That's very helpful, I think.
But then the second thing you talked about
yes.
that brings up another complication is the idea of like remarketing and cookies and things being traced online. And that actually is not going to be covered, is not covered entirely under GDPR because there's separate regulation for that called the e-privacy regulations. And that there's a new one coming in. So the one that required you to have the cookie notice and privacy policies, the one that meant that people were putting these banners on the top of their websites, which weren't expressly required, but they were done as good practice. But that idea of notifying people of cookies and having people consent every time they go onto a site and being able to show what cookies are on, that's an e-privacy regulation and not GDPR. And there's going to be some changes to a new one. They were hoping to bring that out at the same time as GDPR, but it hasn't happened for many reasons. The understanding is that there will be a shift in how this works, and actually a shift that I think is going to be more positive for the small businesses, especially that use websites for retail and for advertising
purposes. Right.
And that is to shift the burden of cookies and cookie notice to the browsers themselves.
Is that right? That's an interesting change.
Yeah, so that you'll have to, when you set up a browser for the first time or when anything changes, the browser has to prompt you to select your cookie choices. And it has to explain to you what each cookie will do and let you determine which cookies you want to have placed on your computer. You can do that already, but it's going to become more of a proactive, and it's more of a targeted approach as opposed to each page having to explain to you and opting out or opting in. And then if you go to a page that has that would is trying to download a cookie onto your machine that you've blocked through your browser settings, it can let you know that, and at that time you can decide whether or not you make an exception for that site.
I see, right.
So that's not for sure what's going to happen, but that's our understanding of what it is leaning towards.
That's your understanding of how the e-privacy directive or regulations will change, and yes. Those won't come into effect immediately in terms of in May, but they will come into effect soon. So that's helpful to know. Thanks very much for that, Heather. Great. Then back to GDPR. The potential fines are significant, 20 million euros or 4% of a brand's total global annual turnover.
Correct.
I understand. Now, I imagine, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the ICO will rely on consumers to report breaches, and there will be some serious breaches, I expect. If you're a small organization and you think, oh, well, I don't have to deal with this because there are going to be lots of larger companies who are again going to get it wrong, they'll be reported and the ICO will target them.
Oh, well, but wouldn't that be nice?
Exactly. And you wouldn't be compliant if you sort of just relied on not being caught in any case, and actually you are potentially at risk of losing your business or your social enterprise or charity being liable for a significant penalty, a huge fine.
Absolutely. And in fact, that already happens under the existing data protection rules.
Yeah.
And that the difference with the fines now are that it's just as likely that a large company will be severely harmed by a breach as opposed to just small companies, because as we've experienced, there have been breaches of the existing act where, say, a small business, a restaurant in Liverpool, for example, there was one with a CCTV camera breach that turned into a credit card theft issue.
Really?
And yet they didn't realize that their CCTV camera that was overlooking their till, where people were inputting their pins, was not protected enough, and it was vulnerable to being hacked, and it was hacked, and somebody was able to then watch people entering their PIN numbers on the device at the till, and were able to steal personal data that way and credit card information that way. And of course the fine was quite serious. It was for that small business, it was a £20,000 fine. And for a small business in Liverpool, small restaurant in Liverpool, that was enough to put them out of business.
Yes, I bet it was. Yeah.
Gosh. So it can happen that it is down to a lot of the consumer complaining. So if a consumer complains, it doesn't matter the size of the business; they're going to come after them. But now you have, TalkTalk, when there was people complaining, and they weren't taking it seriously until the ICO finally got involved. And they still didn't get a fine that would really touch them, because the largest fine they could give, the ICO, was at the time £500,000. But I believe the fine ended up being £400,000. And that's a drop in the bucket for TalkTalk.
Yes.
And it doesn't affect them, whereas 4% of global turnover would possibly wipe out their profit margin for a year.
Quite indeed, it would. Yeah. So dramatic potential impacts here. And,
it doesn't take the risk away from the small businesses, I think, is the point I need to make, but it spreads the risk more evenly.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. Good. Okay. And under GDPR as well, we might well see that businesses, social enterprises and organizations, charities, all types of organizations start to be asked more often about the data that they hold on people. So you should expect, if you're running any type of organization,
people to approach you and to ask for the data that you hold on them. And that's going to start happening more and more.
It's already happening more and more because subject access requests, or SARs, were something that existed under the Data Protection Act 1998.
Yes.
The change with GDPR will be that you can no longer charge somebody who is requesting data for that access to data, or make it difficult to provide that data and provide it in a form that's not accessible, or take a longer time, or make them jump through a lot of hoops. So you cannot charge for more than a single copy. If they request additional copies, you can charge a reasonable fee for additional copies, and the time period is reduced. So people are now increasing their SARs, subject access requests already in businesses. And I don't know if it's because now people are aware that this is a right that they already had, or they're testing the waters of these companies. We're finding it even for law firms, such as some of the Magic Circle law firms in London are having a massive uptick in the amount of subject access requests by current and former clients,
right?
For collection agent, those firms that act as collection agencies for other companies. So people accessing it, trying to get that data.
I see. Okay. So we could expect perhaps an increase in what's already possible.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to be well aware of the fact that their existing policies might describe a charge for providing data in response to a request for data. I mean, I've seen a lot of privacy policies that say you can write to our MD and request the data we hold about you, and mm-hmm. there will be a £10 or £15 processing charge. And people need to remove that as well.
Correct.
As you've described. Okay, that's helpful, Heather. That's mm-hmm.
And they also need to be aware of the fact that there is that right that people have specific to access their data, but also that there are some rights on behalf of the company to legitimately deny access to certain information. And they it's not an open book. Subject access requests are supposed to be fair. They're not supposed to be a carte blanche, open door to whatever they want. So each business may want to look at whether there are specific exceptions that apply to them or that are across the board. And there's also the right to say if a particular subject is harassing with their access requests, then they have the right to seek redress with the ICO as well. Feel like it's being done in a pecuniary manner.
I see. Okay, that's really helpful. That's very, very a good point for people to be aware of and to understand too. So some degree of protection there in terms of if you're being subject to requests that are perhaps being done in what might be described as a malicious way. Okay, helpful. Thanks for that, Heather.
We're open for business life.
You're listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise program with me, Jamie Veitch. Guest today, Dr. Heather Anson of Anson Evaluates. Now, Heather's been talking about GDPR. We're going to take a quick break now for a track of music, but then we'll be back. So don't go away. Enjoy the music.
We're open for Business Live.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise program with me, Jamie Veitch, and joining me for an interview today, Dr. Heather Anson of Anson Evaluate. Heather's been on the program before. She has also worked with Digital Law UK, and she has a huge amount of multi-jurisdiction expertise when it comes to GDPR, but multi-jurisdiction expertise when it comes to digital law. So, Heather, welcome back. Thanks for being on the show again today.
And thank you again for having me back.
So GDPR, you've given us some really helpful advice there before the song, before the music. Listeners who've only just tuned in shouldn't panic, because the podcast will be up on today's programme, will be up on the Sheffield Live website later on. But tell me, Heather, have we covered everything you need to know? There's more, isn't there? I think there's much more in terms of GDPR. Where should we go next?
Oh, there's so much more, but I'll try and keep it to the most important things. The most important things for me as far as actual compliance, we covered questions being asked and other things, but what I think is most important for compliance is one, the training aspect of it. Okay. Making sure that your staff, if you're working with anyone, and if you have a DPO, data protection officer, in-house, that they're trained. Even before GDPR, again, I'll go back to the ICO. Whenever they launched an investigation, one of the first questions was, when was the last time you did data protection training, and what was the content of that training, and where are the records of that? So training has been and continues to be important, but even more so now as it is specifically codified in GDPR. So getting appropriate training. The problem with that also leads to, though, another problem we're having with the market of data protection specialists, our GDPR specialists. Now, as you know, myself and Peter Wright with Digital Law UK, we've been working in compliance and data protection for a very long time. I think combined we have over 30 years experience in regulatory compliance.
Yes.
And we've been dealing with data protection and the Data Protection Act before GDPR even came along. Yeah. And if a few years ago you looked on, let's say, LinkedIn or did a job search for somebody with data protection experience, you wouldn't find very many people on there, you know, less than a handful, 100 or so, that said they were data protection specialists. Mm-hmm. Now you go into LinkedIn, you'll find, I think at last count, we were coming close to 10,000.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to. But what I think you're saying is there is a lot of bandwagon jumping going on from people who don't necessarily have the breadth and depth and scale of experience nor expertise that some others, some genuine experts such as yourself, do have, and presumably one needs to be very careful of who you work with and whether they have your best interests at heart.
Yes. And there's a couple of ways to sort of check that, because unfortunately there isn't a certification for somebody who is a data protection officer, or certification for trainers. I actually wish there were, because as an expert trainer and data protection specialist, I've had people say, well, what's your certification? What's your rating? And there isn't a legitimate one out there. There are people who have said, come to me and said, well, I've gone to this company and they say they can get me certified as a data protection officer. They can get me certified as data protection compliant. And I said, well, the only people who can provide a legitimate certificate or certification or a seal of approval that you are a data protection GDPR compliant individual is the ICO, and the ICO has not provided such a mechanism.
Right.
They may do in the future. I definitely hope they do, and both Peter and myself and some other people we work with are talking about putting together and have started putting together outlines what that should look like, what the program should look like to become both a certified data protection officer or a certified trainer in data protection or GDPR.
Yes.
Yep. So at the moment, things to look out for when you're looking for training is to avoid the two sides of the spectrum. So avoid free training, because as you say, nothing comes for free.
Mm. Yep.
So if something is for free, that's probably because they're selling a product on the other side of it.
Yep.
And most of the free trainings for GDPR these days are designed to scare the ever-loving you-know-what out of people so that they get scared into then purchasing a product from that person or services from that person for an extraordinary amount of money, which they don't need or shouldn't have.
Right, okay, yeah.
The other side of that is I've been told now of several organizations that are putting on what they call GDPR certification classes. In other words, you take our classes and you become certified in GDPR by the end of it. And they're charging upwards of £2,000-£3,000 for a day of training, which...
Good grief. Yeah.
I know a day's training, and by the end of it, people can feel better about GDPR, but aren't completely ready to go out and be GDPR experts. I even sometimes wonder if I'm qualified to be a data protection officer, even though I deal with this every day. So I think it's absolutely appalling that these companies are charging, not only charging people such an excessive amount and telling them they're certified, but saying you are now a certified DPO or certified general data protection expert when they don't have the ability to really do that, especially one day. Some of the guidance out there from the working Article 29 working group and others say that to really be an expert in regulatory matters, particularly data protection, you have to have at least 6 years experience.
Yes. So one day I'm going to cut it, is it?
Exactly. And it doesn't necessarily, I'm going to say regulatory experience, it doesn't have to be data protection, because obviously I've worked in regulatory compliance for a long time, and not all of it's been GDPR, because I'm American, as you can probably tell, and a lot of my regulatory work has been around tax regulations and other types of and healthcare regulations, and but regulations, dealing with regulations is an art form, and you have to work with it for years to really understand how regulations work and to know that they're the nuance of them. So I think that's an important point.
So promising the earth from one day at considerable expense, simply based on terrifying people and scaring people who have perhaps signed up to some free training through which you terrify them. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of age-old tactic. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Millennium Bug back in 1999-2000.
This is a lot like that, yes.
Yeah, and folks were being frightened into spending money that they didn't need to spend instead of doing the things that they did need to do. Clearly there are snake oil sales folk getting involved around GDPR. Sad to see, but I think your advice on how to spot, how to choose appropriate expertise is going to be very helpful to people.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
No worries. And I'd say the bottom line to compliance, I have a two-word mantra when it comes to how to comply with the general data protection regulations and data protection full stop, and that is demonstrate compliance.
Right, yes. So
the answer to all the questions is demonstrate compliance.
Yeah, I get what you mean there. You need to show, you need to demonstrate your understanding of regulations. And,
or your process behind trying to understand the regulation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Your decision to have a data protection officer or not have a data protection officer, your what training you've had or not had, which your search for compatible software that would work with you, what you've done to try and get compliant. So it's not it is very much a journey. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. So if you're concerned about whether or not your company is compliant, that's a start.
Yeah.
That is legitimately a start. And the fact that you are on a process of learning more, of becoming more knowledgeable, of asking questions, of doing the right thing, doing your best to do the right thing, that is you demonstrating compliance. And you're saying, how do I make sure that I've got, how do I know that I'm being compliant with, say, the consent, the specific informed consent? So, well, if the ICO came asking, how would you demonstrate to them that you're compliant with that? What your process? So think of it as like taking a math quiz. You can't just give the answer. You have to show your work.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And you've touched on something there as well in terms of processes. and your own storage of data. But you said, I think you used the word compliance suppliers or compliance software at some point as well. Now, we are business social enterprise organizations operate these days in the cloud, powered by cloud software, powered by data secured on servers all over the world. And we are giving third parties access to data simply to run our businesses. And we might not fully always understand the true extent to that. And you've alluded to the fact that you need to ensure that the people who you work with, this is your processes are compliant as well.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yeah.
Yes, yes. In fact, this has come up a lot recently, especially with cloud service providers. And because of the distinction in the Act and before, there's a difference between a data processor and a data controller. And a lot of businesses who operate not the cloud providers, but the actual businesses, the interactive businesses, for the most part, those are going to be data controllers. The data controller is going to be the person that collects the data, that decides which data is going to be collected and how that data is going to be used and processed and discarded and whatnot. The processor, it could be the same entity, the same business, but the processor is the one that does the actions, doesn't make the decisions, just does the action.
Right.
So people are, but it's confusing because the term processor sounds like you're actively doing something. When you say you're processing data, so cloud providers have actively asked, they said, well, we're not data processors. We don't do anything but provide them the storage. And thankfully, the GDPR is very clear in that simple storage of data, including cloud storage, storage itself is a form of processing.
Right. Okay.
It's in the language of the law itself. So if you are a cloud storage provider, you have to be compliant with the General Data Protection Act now, and you have to be clear in your contracts with the people who you are providing the cloud service to, that as a cloud service provider, you are a data processor.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The other fairness aspect, I think, of GDPR that's come in, and I talked about how the fines are evening out the playing field in terms of small and big businesses, but the fines used to only apply to data controllers. And all the responsibility for a breach of data protection fell on the controller. That's why a lot of people, including law firms, tried to couch themselves as, we're not data controllers, we're data processors. We don't have the responsibility. But that's no longer the case. Both have equal responsibility in terms of protecting data.
Yeah.
They're different. Their data protection obligations may be different, but they're equal in the sense that both can be fined. So you
right.
can't escape it. So they do have to be responsible for it now. There's no longer that ability to say, oh, well, we're just the processor, so we're not in control.
I see. Okay. Can't shirk your responsibilities. Okay. Great. So that's been really helpful. Thank you ever so much for this, Heather. And it's a complicated topic. Now, I'd like to give you the opportunity to give your own contact details out, if I may, in terms of websites, Twitter, or also whatever your preferred means of people contacting you. That would be fantastic. Before we do, quite aside from GDPR, it's been an interesting time recently when it comes to data generally and data use and people using social media sites and not necessarily realizing where their data was going. So I can only imagine that an expert such as yourself is going to continue to be very, very busy. Any further observations, anything else you'd like to add, whether it's with regards to what we've been hearing in the media about data breaches or perhaps trust breaches or data or GDPR and anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I'd say if you're a business out there, when it comes to GDPR, don't hide your head in the sand, but also don't get overly concerned about it. Be the right amount of concerned, like you would with almost any other, you know, with your HR concerns, with your insurance concerns. It shouldn't be ignored, but it shouldn't be a panic time either. Do this thoughtfully and methodically.
Okay, great. Super. I'm sorry, were you going to add something there or did I cut you off?
I probably wasn't. I don't remember, so it's okay.
No problem. There,
I could go on for days about this, though, so you're probably good to cut me off.
we'll have to get you back in on the show again soon. But Heather Anson, Dr. Heather Anson, Director at Anson Evaluate and Associate also with Digital Law UK, returning to the programme today. Thank you so much for joining us, Heather. Really appreciate you giving your time and expertise to the show and to listeners today. Thank you.
No worries.
We're open for Business Live.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. Our guest today has been Dr. Heather Anson of Anson Evaluate. Heather was talking with us about GDPR. She's gone into a huge amount of detail, and this is a really key topic for any business, social enterprise, any charity, any organisation. If you handle data, it's going to affect you. It's going to affect pretty much everybody. Now, if you've only just tuned in and you've missed the interview with Heather, then don't panic. It will be up on the podcast section of the Sheffield Live website from about 11 a.m. today. Go to sheffieldlive.org, look at radio shows, find Business Live, and the show will be there. If you want to get in touch with Heather, then you can do so. You can email her, heather@digitallawuk.com. You can also find her on LinkedIn and just go to digitallawuk.com/about, and you'll see a profile of Heather, and you can find her LinkedIn profile there as well. So really appreciate Heather taking the time to talk with us today and to give us such a detailed and in-depth view in terms of what you need to know when it comes to GDPR. Thank you so much, Heather. Thank you for listening today, and we will be back on air next Friday. Don't go away now. Next up on Sheffield Live, the folk music programme, so enjoy that. And we'll play out now with a track of music. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
We're open for Business Live.